Thank you. And my name is Barbara Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. And it is by God's grace this program and you people. My dry date's August 14th, 1982. Yeah. So, I didn't know that was coming, but y'all know how this works. It's like, and you know, it was kind of the same way at our house, what he was talking about, that my husband Bob called, said, "Did you check the email? You need to check the email. You got something from GSO." And then a couple of days later, I called him. I said, "You need to check the email at the office because they want you to do something at the international." And he gets to chair and I get to speak. So it's the girl's rule. Because our egos are not near as big as y'all. And when I first got here, and I didn't wake up one day and call Alcoholics Anonymous or treatment, that some other people were real tired of me doing what I'd been doing. And they said there was a barbecue and a dance at White River Lake, and I went and got in the car because it had been a couple of days since I'd had anything, and I knew there was going to be a dance, and there's going to be lots of drinking and a bunch of other stuff. And so I just went and got in the car, and thank God they were thinking for me because they packed the bag, because I was just going in shirts and a T-shirt and shorts and barefooted, because that's kind of how I run around unless we were going dancing. And I was looking really cute. I thought, I weighed about 75 or 80 pounds, and, you know, thank God, I was getting another divorce, and she was talking, you know, they talk about you whenever you're not around, and so Clyde was 6 months sober, and he made a 12-step call. I don't know what he said, other than the party, and, you know, a lot of things happened, and when we got the breaching the walls of ego, I'm like, I don't remember reading that in the book. You know, in fact, I didn't remember reading that in any of our literature. So I thought, well, you don't know what it means. And I got the Webster Dictionary out, and we've got an old one because that's what Bill used, was really old. And I wanted to make sure we had the right definition, not the new definition. But I thought I knew what it said, and I did, you know, breaking a contract. And I was trying to relate that with, you know, so I've had sponsees thinking about their life and how they breached the walls of ego. And, you know, and I got to thinking about this, and one's here. They had none of them brought that topic up again since I asked them. So it's, you know, and that's not right. They just don't follow directions. And, but I thought I did real good because I didn't call them and ask them again. I just, you know, it was a test. And that's what we do. That's what we do. And I know for me, a couple of days after I got out of, well, I came to, or woke up, whatever you want to call it, and they started doing, you know, they loved me back to health is what they did. And they loved me with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was very fortunate because every meeting was out of a 12 and 12 big book. And back then, the 24-hour book. There was Alcoholics Anonymous. Just, you know, we had a couple of meetings a week, and outsiders came in, and all of y'all really scared me. And we'd say the Lord's Prayer, and I'd run and hide in the room again. And there's some ego deflation whenever you talk about step one for me. Because I grew up, I've got three brothers, and I mean, I had to learn how to change the flat tire just like the boys did before we got our driver's license. That was a requirement at our house. And you had to learn how to drive a standard. Mom had an automatic, but we had to learn how to drive the standard. And so, you know, I grew up and, you know, just a tomboy and doing, you know, you do the same, don't ask for help, you know. And throughout the years, I still am learning how to breached the wall of my ego. And it gets a little easier. Sometimes it's not very easy, but because my ego demands that I know. That was the hardest thing for me to do, is to say, I don't know. And I was very blessed that I lived in a shelter for women, and that was a test, because we don't like women when we get here. I mean, y'all take my boyfriend away from me, and, you know, it's not a good deal. And I promise, I was a barroom drinker, too. So, you know, we do what we have to do. And so I get there, and after I was 13 months sober, and the director of the shelter resigned, and so they made me the interim director. Now, I wasn't still living there, but I'll tell you that I was at that women's shelter for 6 years, and what I do is I lead you to believe that I lived there 6 years, you know, because that sounds good to me. And really, and that's sick, because who stays 6 years in a women's shelter? I mean, you know, and that's that, you know, that thinking. And but there are things that I've had to surrender to, and I know that every time I surrender, it's defeat, you know, breaching that, the wall of my ego just a little bit more, because I can get into, you don't know who I am. You don't know who Bob and I are. I mean, you know, I can go there in our area, because we've been around. I mean, he's going to have 51 years next month. So, I mean, you know, you travel around. You can't go to a meeting and just be an AA member sometime. Most of the time, they want you to talk. And y'all don't help us any. I mean, you don't want us to read how it works, but you want us to talk. But it's hard. It's hard to, you know, and that feeds my ego, you know. And I appreciate the girls I sponsor. Boy, if I get a little over here, they're pretty good to say, hey, what are you doing? You know, and it's like, and I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, and I do service work at my home group, and I welcome the newcomers. Every Saturday we go and clean at 1 o'clock and fix the big coffee pot, you know, for the Saturday night meeting. We don't know what they're going to do tomorrow, because Bob sets the timer most of the time. So we'll see how the coffee is, because they'll report that it didn't come on at the right time. And, you know, it's there are different situations and circumstances that I have the privilege today to walk through instead of run away from. Because when I got here, I was a runner. I've been married several times, and that's anything over three is several. So, y'all, the book talks about how we were runners, you know. And I am, because when things start getting, I mean, I get bored in marriages. And I'm just done, you know, and I don't pick very well. I'm not a good picker. And sometimes I marry people that don't work, and this is an ego deal, because I'm making all the money and bringing it in, and I have rights, you know, and I can you know, you really need to get the clothes washed or something, you know. And you know, I just my head just goes, you know, and I take a drink, and then it slows down a little bit. And, you know, I learned in early sobriety that, you know, alcohol had to do something for me before it did something to me. And I understand that, and I've understood that for a really long time. And I understand that the book talks about cease fighting anything or anybody, even myself, and that's the biggie. Is fighting myself. You know, you walk through deaths, you walk through different illnesses, either you or your spouse or kids, or, you know, and what do you do if you have to bury a grandbaby? You know, I mean, the drinking is not an option. You know, you go and you be a service to your kids. When my mother-in-law died, I thought I was done. My mother was a drunk, and she was a running drunk, and so I didn't have much to do with her, and I stayed real mad at her for a long, long time. And my mother-in-law filled that void, and I had to be willing to be a service to her kids, you know, and it wasn't about me. And I always want everything to be about me. I don't want, you know, and it's just not. It's just not. It's about y'all, and it's about what can I do. I'll just go ahead and put this out there. Two and a half years ago, I got diagnosed with breast cancer. And, you know, I was self-confined to the house because I wasn't going to get sick. It was so cold that winter. I went to one meeting a month. And when my immune system got back up, but I didn't get sick, you know. I don't know where I was going with that. But anyway, I'm good now. I am good. I mean, I have been, my numbers are excellent. The doctor told me they're better than his, so that's good. And, you know, how do you walk through that stuff? You know, you talk to your sponsees, you read the book, read a lot of the books. We have a lot of books. We've been here a long time. And, you know, a lot of speaker tapes. There are things that, you know, I get to thinking about those people that live in Canada and different places. And, you know, they can't just jump in the car and run around the corner to the meeting, but they stay sober, you know, and they grow spiritually. And I think for me, this deflation of ego, that's what I'm used to. And every time I apply the principle of one of the steps, I believe that it deflates that ego a little bit more. You know, I'm not ashamed of my past today. And you know, like any other woman, we've done what we had to do. And I can share that with the girls I work with, some of them. Some of them, they're not trustworthy, so you can't share everything. But you can share most of it, and you pick and choose. But it's a deal that, you know, I'm so very grateful. We were sitting out there yesterday, and, you know, it's real easy to get to thinking that I'm somebody. And you look at the people coming in, Bob and I was talking about that we're just one little person in this deal. In life, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful that the first word is we. We had a convention a couple of years ago. The chairman wanted we as the theme, and we're all like, what? I mean, we, dot, dot, dot. I'm like, it's the craziest thing I ever heard. But the more I thought about it, it's like, that's right, we. You know, it takes all of us. And it takes all of us in every group and every convention. I know how hard it is for a convention. We're involved in ours in Lubbock, and it's registration is what I like because I like to watch the money. And not really, but when Bob and I got active in our convention, we didn't even have enough to pay the deposit on the hotel, so we've worked real hard at having that prudent reserve. And you know, it's hard to tell people that you can't come. You know, you're out there hustling to get scholarships, and you're doing this, and you're doing that, and then the reward is watching everybody, you know, and seeing the smiles on their face, and nobody's fighting, nobody's, you know, you think about it, if we was all drinking in here, how many would be fighting? I mean, somebody said something the other night, if we wanted a drink at one of the restaurants, or if we were drinking down here, there's a wine tasting something. And Bob and I both, about the same time, said, y'all don't have enough wine in Atlanta for all these people. Because I like wine. I mean, I like Strawberry Hill wine. That's where, you know. And the way I drink is I like to drive around in the Monte Carlo with all the windows rolled down drinking wine, and I've got the radio station on Del Rio. And that's a Spanish station. And drive a little while, drink a little while, and woohoo! Yeah, you know, yeah, yeah, yeah! And there's nobody in the car but me. You know, I mean, I just ride around the back roads. And but it filled that hole on the inside. And, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps and you people. And working with others and doing all the things that we're taught to do is what fills that hole on the inside. And it's not dark and it's not, you know, the book says that God is everything or he's nothing. And today I can tell you that God, the God of my understanding, is everything. And that whatever it is that we walk through, you know, I can get to the other side and not have to drink. And you know, God's sufficient unto all my needs, and that's all he wants. And to act kind of nice every once in a while, you know. And it's good. Life is good. And I'm excited. We've been so excited to get here. It's unreal. And anyway, it's an honor and a privilege to get asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, even this. I didn't think so for a little while. But, you know, I opened that email and started crying. I called Bob. I said I was crying. And he says, "Why are you crying?" I said, "Oh, because I'm grateful." He goes, "I know. I know." Of course, he saw me when I went into treatment, so he knows how cute I was. And he'll comment about that. He owns a pawn shop, and that's where I took all my stuff. So it's, you know. But this says something, you know. He's getting it right, because his first wife was Barbara, and he married, my name's Barbara, and I said, you don't have to worry about getting the name wrong. I mean, there's some benefits to that. And so it's a good deal. And again, I'm grateful y'all filled the room up. I was hoping nobody showed up. But it's, you know, I'm glad y'all are here. We're going to have a good party, and we'll just, you know, rock on is all I know. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Wow. Bob, I would like to invite you to join me in my new all-man support group called Men Who Are With Women Who Get to Talk at the International. Anybody else? We're going to meet at 11 right outside the room. I'm so thrilled and honored to introduce our next speaker, who is John C. from Illinois.
I brought the rowdy group with me. None of you are rowdy, right? Good morning. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. There's no truth to the rumor that you have to have a partner or a spouse to be invited to speak, although it seems that way so far this morning. And my ego is speaking when I wonder why they put us in the smallest room possible. And I figured it out. They figured there's not many alcoholics with egos. You don't have any, I don't, so. But anyway, my sobriety date is May 26, 2001. And I was a 30. I know I'm a pup compared to many of you in the room here. I was a daily drinker for over 32 years, and two of the people closest to me who suffered through a lot of that are sitting right back there. And anyway, so when I came to AA, I thought I knew the language. I thought I knew a lot of things. And Bill Wilson drove me to the dictionary with his precise and beautiful use of our language. Really, seriously, I mean that. He was a fantastic writer. And so I went to the dictionary a lot, and I still do. So I had to look up breaching before our session here. And it means to knock a hole in something, a hole or an opening. It doesn't mean to tear something down completely, which in the title itself tells me I can't tear my ego down completely. I can't live. I can't be me without some ego. And then I looked up ego, and in the sense that we're using it today, it means the self, the thing, the part of our psychology that makes us different, our self. And you know, page 62 in the big book, I was 3 months, in fact, it was in August of 2001, I was sitting at the in the basement of the Methodist Church in Salem, Wisconsin, and his name was John N. M., and he was reading page 62 in the big book where it says that selfishness and self-centeredness are our root problem and that our troubles are of our own making. That knocked me between the eyes, and that's been the focus of my program ever since. And so I have not knocked down my walls of ego, but at least I'm aware of it now and working on it. I can give you two examples of what ego, well, two good examples of how ego can be displayed. One of them happened right here in Atlanta in the airport. About 20 years ago, I was down here on business, and maybe some of you have had the experience. It's hard to get out of Atlanta sometimes. There's a lot of delays. We were waiting for our flight to be called, and they announced that there would be a three-hour delay. And, of course, everybody runs up to the counter there at the gate trying to get put on different flights. And there weren't many openings left, so a few people got put on other flights. And the last guy, the next person up in line, when they had filled all the other flights, tall gentleman, said in a booming voice, they denied him, you know, they said he couldn't get a seat. In this booming voice, he said, "But you don't understand. I'm important." And he immediately endeared himself to all of us. And he went on to say, "I'm important. I have people waiting for me." And he repeated, "I'm important." And I thought, "You've got to be kidding. You must be on Mars. You know, everybody around is looking and laughing and saying other things." That was a pretty good example of ego. And the next one was me. Because my two beloved people sitting in this room joined the program quite a long time before I did. Our daughter was first in the program at a tender age. My wife followed a while afterward. And I stopped drinking at that time. That was all I needed. I didn't need to go to any meetings. I didn't need this God stuff. I didn't need any of that because I was cool. And I went that way for 6 years. And it was 6 years of absolute misery, unpleasantness, it was awful. And then I had a spiritual awakening one day at a family counseling meeting of all places and knew I had to come here. And since then, my life has been incredibly different. And I owe it all to the program, the people in it, the literature, meetings, all of these things. But given my background of an egotistical behavior and lack of judgment, I didn't think that I was the person to give you any advice on what to do about ego. So I went to my home group. My home group is the Men's Shed meeting, S-H-E-D, in Fox Lake, Illinois on Sunday mornings. And I asked them for some advice on what to do about ego, advice that they could pass along to you instead of my advice. So I've got some remarks from them. And they kind of fell into natural groupings. Several of them talked about working with others or thinking with others. Tom W. keeps trying to stay open-minded and listen to and think of others as much as possible. And Ron F. also wants to think of the other person. And he said something interesting. He said, "If I stumble, I try to fall forward so that I'm still making progress." And that's something to work on. And Brian A., who's been through an awful lot of things, he just said he just keeps trying to think of others instead of himself. And his actions and his remarks reflect that. And so that works for those people. Several talked about honesty. You know, and to me, honesty is in every one of our steps. You have to have some level of honesty to do step one all the way through step 12. You can't do any of those things if you're dishonest with yourself. Wally Z., who's in the room this morning, he keeps reminding himself to admit that he needs help, being honest with himself about that need. Steve tries to practice honesty and accept the input of others. Boy, that's not easy, I can tell you. Ask me how I know. John C. tries to recognize when his ego takes over and to keep it in check. So that honesty, yes, I do have an ego, and it is getting out of line, and I do need to do something about it. Several people talked about working the steps, how the steps help them. Ron M. focuses on the third step concept of turning things over, an excellent way to escape your ego. And Dave D. said he had to give up his plan and surrender. Did you have a plan? I had one. Mine lasted 6 years, and you know how well it worked. Several talked about spirituality. Dave N. Had to stop the whirlwind, he said, and to begin to appreciate spirituality. And I'm like that, too. I didn't want anything to do with that stuff when I walked in these doors. And there's a whole new world of it out there. If you haven't found it, look for it. It's there, believe me. Gary F. turned to the spirituality that he ignored while drinking, as did I. Bill K. just simply said he keeps asking God for help. A couple talked about a higher power. Don N., he noted very interestingly that walls have two sides. They keep things out and they keep things in. And he says your ego can be both a fortress and a trap. And those traps lead to isolation. And I know what that's like. I was so isolated those last few days and weeks and months before I joined this program. I can't describe it. I was in my own world. And Jerry M., he said he had to learn how to listen and not fuel his ego with alcohol. He talks to many others in the program, and he says to trust the guy in the sky. This gentleman, Jerry M., has over 40 years of sobriety and started as the typical Skid Row drunk and is the most exact opposite of that kind of life that you can just imagine. So those are some of my friends in my home group, what they had to say. And for myself, I found that a rigorous self-examination is very important for me to keep my head in the right path. I have to be able to look at myself honestly and rigorously, to have to do it often, and try to look at myself through eyes that are not my own. And that doesn't mean that we have to beat ourselves up. But it does help me to identify things that I need to work on and ways not to be. And I wish I could do it more than I do, but I'm doing it a lot more now than I did 14 years ago. And so to me, the one way to work on my ego, to breach the walls of ego, is to let some light into that ego, to expose it, to be honest about it, to see that it's there, and to look at how I can work on that kind of thing. Ego is the definition of it, is the self, the thing that sets us apart, the things, you know, we want to be better, stronger, faster, richer, more beautiful, whatever. And those things automatically separate us from other people. And what do we come to AA for? We came here for love and understanding, to be together. Human beings need to be together, whether we say we do or not. Alligators are born to kill and eat the second they hatch. We're not reptiles. We're human beings. We need each other. We have to have people hold us and feed us and clean us the moment we're born. And many of us, that happens at the end of lifetime too. We have to be together. And what do we do? What do? I let my ego separate me from you. I want to be in front of you on the road. I don't want you standing in the top of the stairway or at the opening of the elevator. I'm first. I'm different. I'm special. And that kind of feeling separates me from you. And believe me, I spent too much of my life feeling myself separate from other people, and I don't want that anymore. When I came to AA, the place that I didn't want to come, the place that I didn't need, after my first meeting, I did 400 meetings in 300 days. I couldn't get enough because I hadn't had that feeling in my head in my lifetime up until then. And talking to people and hearing what they had to say and sharing their experiences and helping them through tough times. You know, working with other people is an automatic way to get me out of myself, to get to breach that wall of ego. Because I can't work with anybody if I'm tied up in my ego, if that wall is still built up solid. I have to be able to open it up and let the sunlight in and, you know, try to help the other person and not for my own benefit. We get some benefit, obviously, from helping other people, but The real benefit, obviously, is to see them, to see the light go on and to see them stay sober another day. Interestingly enough, when I first got into AA, naturally having large amounts of ego left, I wanted to get in service, not to serve you, but to serve me. And so I got involved in the district doing our district newsletter, District 11, Area 20 in Northern Illinois, by the way. And I realized that these district meetings, it was like taking a drink because my ego would spring up. You know, I disagreed with that person. I knew more than that other person, and I didn't want to, you know, yada, yada, yada. And it got to the point where when we rotated out of those positions, I stayed away from service for a while because it was like taking a drink. And I went to, got involved in conferences and things, but I didn't want to get into that next level of service. And it wasn't until really the last few years that I've been willing to do that. Now I'm back in at the area level, working on the website, and I can tell you it does work. I am able now to sit in an area meeting and to some extent, love and accept what other people are doing, and realize that, you know, they're not doing what I don't like because I don't like it. They're all trying their best. So I'm more involved in activities now and appreciating it more and enjoying it more, and realizing, too, that those people, some of those people that I disapproved of, you know, are the reason we're here. Because without those districts and areas, we don't have meetings. We wouldn't have meetings to go to or books to read. And so my hat's off to them, and hopefully I can keep my ego parked in its proper place. It's always going to be there. I understand that, and but as long as I can and keep looking at it, exposing it, working at it, and listening to my friends and taking their advice, listening to my sponsor, you know, life is so much better. And as a result of these steps, my mantra has been that I've been younger, I've been healthier, but I've never been happier. And I feel so good being in AA. You know, I feel so good. I got lots left over for you. So that's all I have this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, John. And please let the members of your home group know we appreciate their input. That was pretty unique. I liked it. And it is my pleasure and privilege to introduce our next speaker, Misty from Idaho.
Good morning. My name is Misty, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 31st of 2009. My sponsor, Madeline, is here in the room, so I have to be very honest. My home group is Dingalings. We meet every Wednesday at 8 in Meridian, Idaho, at a fire station. I'm not Heidi. Some of you probably saw that Heidi was supposed to have been speaking here in the program. She, unfortunately, about 3 weeks ago, something happened. She's not here. I'm here instead, so you're stuck with me. So growing up, I had the most amazing family. I'm not one of the people that can say I grew up in an alcoholic home and bad things happened to me. My family was amazing, no alcoholism. I was always showered with love, taught I was perfect. given everything I wanted. But my mind, it was always going so, so, so fast. I could never accept things just the way that they were. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. In fact, my mind, and it still does that, it goes so fast that my nickname that my sponsor gave me is Hamster Girl, because it's like the mind, the hamster wheel, and it's going so fast. The big book on pages 60 to 61 has the part where it says, each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangement would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Then it goes on, our ego, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. And that has just always been me to a T. I had my first drink when I was 15. My friend Monica and I went to this party, and all the people were around. They were playing this drinking game, and they were all playing it with beer. And there was this bottle of brandy, and I said something like, "What's that?" And someone said, "Well, that's brandy, and you could never play this game with brandy." And I was like, "Psh, I can play this game with brandy." So that's my last memory. But according to Monica, she, you know, helped me out to the car. I had one shoe on, one shoe off. I puked the whole way home out the side of her window to her parents' house, of course. We were 15. And she thought it would be a good idea to just drop me right when we walked in the front door in the formal living room on this beautiful white couch. And I shit my pants. So that was my first drink. And I fell in love with alcohol. I mean, that's the worst part, right? Fell in love. I was like, it made my mind stop, you know? It stopped the obsessions. Like, this is my solution to the obsessions of my mind. And from then on, so I was 15, I got sober at 27. So for the next 12 years, it was off and running. In A New Pair of Glasses on page 7, Chuck C. defines ego, and he defines ego as the feeling of conscious separation from God, from each other, and eventually from ourselves. I love that definition. My ego was the driving force behind absolutely everything I did. I thought only of myself, and for like that 10 years of drinking, I had so much fun. I mean, I had a wonderful time. And then that last, like, year and a half, the obsession was, where do I get more to flow? Okay, like, where can I find it? Where's the next one coming from? How can I be happy again? What happened? Why am I miserable? Why has alcohol stopped working for me? It worked for me so, so well. How can I arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, so I'm not restless, irritable, and discontent all the time? As the big book says on page 61, I was that self-centered, ego-centered actor, a victim of the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only managed well enough. You know, I destroyed friendships. I broke my family's heart over and over and over again. I finally got a DUI while I was in school, and I went to rehab because my lawyer said you can get an inattentive driving if you go to rehab. So I was like all over it. And it was just that, you know, I can rest if I only manage well. And that last 2 years, it was constantly what I thought about. If I try harder, if I get better grades, if I eat less, if I exercise more, if I shop less, if I take different types of pills, if I drink more coffee, if I take vitamins, if I do this, you know, I'm going to be happy again. I just have to try harder if I only managed well, right? So when I left treatment, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a couple of the people that I met very first are in this room today, so they saw how crazy I was. I wanted you guys to teach me how to drink normally and how to not take drugs when I drank. And I wanted my family just to get off my back. And I wanted to be happy again. I wanted you to show me how to be happy again. So I picked this pushover sponsor that is not sober. Are we not allowed to cuss in here? Nobody said a curse word. No curse words. So I half butted my way through the steps. I saw myself always as different from you guys, always. I was in law school. I had this amazing Cleaver Partridge family. You know, I had my stuff together for the most part. And I didn't need AA. It wasn't like die or do AA. I thought you guys were being very dramatic. On page 46 in the 12 by 12, I mean, this was me. It says, the sponsors of those who feel they need no inventory are confronted with quite another problem. This is because people who are driven by pride of self unconsciously blind themselves to their liabilities. These newcomers scarcely need comforting. The problem is to help them discover a chink in the walls their ego has built through which the light of reason can shine. Okay, at that time, my walls of ego were like the Berlin Wall, the Great Wall of China. I mean, they were like, you could not penetrate them. Like, no way. And I didn't stay sober. You know, I got a lot worse. And I got a lot worse really fast. So my last drink was toward the end of August of 2009. I had just started school, like, the middle of August, and I already needed a break, I guess. So it was a tough week and a half. It was a killer week and a half. So I was going to school up in northern Idaho, and I decided I was going to go to Vegas for a couple days. And I was going by route of Spokane, Washington, because I needed – it was easy to get some things that I needed in Spokane that I needed to be okay. And I see this hitchhiker on the side of the road. And see, at that time, I couldn't be alone. Like, I could not be alone because of these obsessions of the mind, and I just needed someone there to distract me from what was going on in my life. So I pick up Nola, this hitchhiker, and she wanted to go to Seattle, and I was like, well, whatever, let's go to Seattle. So we went to Seattle, and we are crashing at her ex-boyfriend's apartment. They sell drugs through, like, this little, I mean, like, they just open the hole in the door, and people put money through, and they pass out drugs. I had never seen anything like, I'm from Idaho. I had never even seen anything like that before, and there were these Jamaican guys with accents, and they kicked her out. But they let me stay. They liked me. And I had my dog. So Hillary was with me. Hillary was always with me. And I had forgotten a leash for her. So I was using, like, a lampshade that they cut off. And that was how I was getting around Seattle with her. So at some point, I decided to go get cigarettes. So Hillary and I buzz out and we drive to get cigarettes. And I was going to skip this part, so I had to put Hillary to sleep a couple weeks ago, but anyway, so I pull up and I leave her in my car and I buzz in to get cigarettes and I forget where she's, I forget where I'm parked. So I come out and I don't see my car and I, you know, I walk one way and I walk the other way and I call the drug dealers and bless their hearts, they like get the whole compound down there looking for my car with me. So I mean, there's like nine Jamaican guys walking all up and down the U District, and they're going, "What do you remember?" And I was like, "I parallel parked," because I mean, I was so messed up at this point. I had not been sober in a long time. So 8 hours later, Hillary's in this car. It's 90 degrees. All the windows are up. She has no water. And 9 hours later, we found her, and she was fine. I called my sponsor when I had to put her down a few weeks ago. I said, "I'm not done making my living amends to her yet. You know, I'm still working on it." But anyways, so they helped me find my car. Hillary's fine. And at that point, my card stops working. And I had gotten a lot of student loan money deposited in my account like the beginning of August. So the fact that my card wasn't working at the end of, you know, end of August was a bad sign. But I had an ex-boyfriend that lived in Tacoma. So I called him and I was like, "Dude, I need gas money to get back to Moscow." So he meets me at the Starbucks, and I walk in there, and Hillary's on a lampshade leash. I weigh, like, 90 pounds. I haven't showered. I haven't slept in days, you know. And I'm sitting there with him, and I'm kind of shaking a little bit, and he looks down, and, like, my foot, there's blood all over my foot. And he's like, "You need to get sober. Like, what's wrong with you?" And, like, I couldn't see it. I mean, that was my ego. I couldn't see it. I could not see what I looked like. You know, I honestly believed that, like, I looked good. I had my stuff together. I was doing good. That's where I was at. And I was just like, I thought he wanted to get back together with me, to be honest. Ego. And I just looked at him, and I was like, I would rather die than be boring. And then driving back to Moscow, I hallucinated the whole way home. Like, I saw stuff in the middle of the road, and I'm going on Snoqualmie Pass, and I'm coming to a complete stop because my grandpa's in the middle of the road that had died. But there's kids in the middle of the road. There's all these things in the middle of the road. And I finally make it back to Moscow, and I think I went to a meeting. I don't know, but I ended up at the bars again that night, and I drank all night long. I'm walking up and down the streets of Moscow at like 5 a.m. and I'm mumbling to myself and I'm seeing people that are like out for their morning walks and they're just looking at me. And even at that moment, I was just like practicing my opening argument for court tomorrow. And, you know, I had something to say. I don't know. And at some point, like as I'm doing that, all of a sudden, like I finally got to that point that the book talks about where I couldn't imagine my life anymore with alcohol, and I couldn't imagine my life anymore without alcohol. And that was a scary, scary, scary place to be. I experienced true loneliness, and I finally saw myself for what I was, the way everybody else saw me. And now, and I asked for help, and I didn't even say, I cussed, I said F you, and then I said F it. And those two like little slogans was actually me asking for help, and my higher power saw what I meant by it. And then all of a sudden, my old sponsor's house was right in front of me, and she let me come in and loved me, and she's here somewhere. She's not in here, but she's here somewhere. She told me like 4 years later I hit on her husband, but she didn't kick me out. So when I got the call like 3 weeks ago, my sponsor called and asked if I wanted to be on this panel because Heidi wasn't going to be here. And I was running late to this meeting I was going to, and I was vacationing with my family in Hilton Head this last week, and I was actually planning not to get here until noon today. So I was like, well, I wasn't planning to get there till noon, not at 9:30, and I'd have to rent my car and drive myself, and I don't know. I'll let you know. So I like hung up the phone, and I'm walking into the meeting, and at that moment my husband calls, and we have this 10-month-old baby, cutest baby ever, and Scott's like, I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is Peyton said his first word. The bad news is it was Dada. And I was like, so I get in, I'm sitting in this meeting, and I don't hear how it works. I don't hear the 12 traditions. I don't hear the first five people share because the obsessions are going, right? I'm like, Dada. Does Dada do his laundry? Does Dada take him to daycare? Does Dada pick him up from daycare? Does Dada buy his food? Does Dada feed him? Like, does Dada love him? Like, could Dada even take care of him by himself for 2 days? I don't think so. And, And then all of a sudden, my sponsor texts me, and it's like, rental car, $49. And I was like, what was the name of that panel she wanted me to be on? Was it like something about breaching through the walls of ego? Yes. And then I actually think, so my name's not on the program. Not even on the program. There was too long of a line for me to get my badge, so probably nobody here is going to remember my name. It's Misty. No badge, but it's Misty. I-E at the end. No. Ego Buster, right? So on page 55 of the 12 and 12, it says that all of AA's 12 steps ask us to go contrary to our natural desires. They all deflate our egos. When it comes to ego deflation, few steps are harder to take than five. I love what Chuck C. says about ego deflation in A New Pair of Glasses. He talks about when I'm doing my four step, when I'm doing the moral inventory and I'm trying to find the patterns, the driving force behind what I've done and why. He says, if I want to get real simple, the whole thing will boil down to obsessions of the mind, which is the ego. Every one of them will boil down to trying to satisfy the human ego, which cannot be done. So we write it down, and then we share it. Sharing it with another human being is the ego buster. And that was, you know, that was me. For the first time ever, the person that I was doing my four step to, they saw me, not the person that I wanted everyone to see. They saw me. And that's really why I didn't want to talk today. I would much rather have chaired, because then I could put on my cute dress and I could smile, and you all would not realize how messed up I was. Because as soon as I opened my mouth and it all comes out, you realize how messed up I am. But really, it's I needed to work the steps of the program to breach the walls of ego because I was messed up. Going to meetings, praying about it wasn't going to do anything for me. Chuck C. says, the only roadblock between me and God and me and you guys is my ego, and I believe that to be true as well. And I'm just going to close with Tradition 12. Unanimity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. I always thought that that step was about confidentiality, what we see in these rooms stays in these rooms, that sort of a thing. But I learned, you know, that it's not. And the long version goes into that the principle of anonymity has immense spiritual significance, and that we are actually to practice a genuine humility in the rooms. I just recently started working with this other woman from my home group, and I brought her home to my house like a month ago. And my husband said something about what time you have court tomorrow, and she said, are you trying to get off probation? I said, no, you know, I'm an attorney. And she didn't know, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm doing something right, you know? Because a lot of the times I'm not, but like if I've been to my home group for this long, and I've shared this many times, and she has no idea what I do for work, then that's a win. Because if I'm going to be happy, joyous, and free, I have to be practicing the 12th tradition, and I have to be working these steps. I have to be breaching the walls of ego. And when I'm in these rooms, you know, I'm not an attorney. I don't have a hot husband and a big, beautiful house and an adorable child and a nice car. Like, I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we walk shoulder to shoulder, and that's what makes me happy. And I'm no better than, and I'm no less than. I'm just one of you guys. And I just want to thank you for allowing me, a broke-down cokehead whore from Idaho, to be of service.